wildly. Her mind ran to the little girl who disappeared months ago, the one they'd never found. She'd lived not too far from Sycamore Glen. Zell raised her voice and yelled the child's name even louder still. Kaylee. I was sitting on Mr. Doyle's back deck eating a fudge pop, my favorite, when I heard Zell hollering for me. I think someone's looking for you, he said, and gestured in the direction of her voice, loud and panic-sounding. I hopped up and went running toward Zell's house, the pop still in my hand. Hey! Hey! I yelled when I rounded the corner and spotted her pacing back and forth in her front yard. I'm over here! I waved my arms over my head, the popsicle dripping a little as I did, droplets like brown rain sprinkling down. Zell was in the front yard, and as soon as she saw me, she stopped moving and stared at me like I was a ghost coming toward her. I crossed the street in a hurry and met her in the middle of her yard. I looked over to see if Mr. Doyle had followed me, but he hadn't. I guessed he went inside to check on his mother. She was taking a nap, but later he was going to take her for a walk in her wheelchair. He said he was waiting till it wasn't hot as Hades to go. He said I was welcome to walk with them, but I said I'd have to ask Zell. He made a face and said it wasn't likely she would say yes. I asked why, and he said, "Long story." Zell gave me a quick hug when I got to her. Then she looked at me like my mother did when she was disappointed. I tried to figure out what I could have forgotten to do for Zell, but I couldn't think of anything. The nice thing about Zell's house was I didn't have to do a thing. She mostly did it all, which was a nice change. "Where were you?" Zell asked. "And where'd you get that fudge pop?" She was acting like I stole it. "From Mr. Doyle," I said, and pointed toward his house like Zell didn't already know where he lived. Then I remembered. At the pool, she'd seen me talking to him after he gave me my trophy and asked me not to ever go to his house. She'd said I didn't have to understand, that I just needed to listen to her. When he offered me the popsicle, I forgot all about that. All I could think of was eating that fudge pop, how cold and good it would taste on a hot day. "I didn't ask him for it," I said really quickly. "He offered." I wanted Zell to see I had good manners, even if I wasn't the best listener in the world. The last thing I wanted was for her to get mad at me and send me home. "Kaylee, please stay away from him. I'm telling you, it's for your own good," Zell pleaded with me, casting a glance at Mr. Doyle's house as she spoke. "He just gave me a popsicle. He said I looked hot out here. He was being nice." I tried to assure her, but she wasn't buying it. Grown-ups sure do like to worry. Even when they don't have anything to worry about, they invent stuff. It was kind of like my mom, telling me not to talk to strangers. My mom had been so wrong. Just look at how nice people had been. I mean, before Cutter's accident, I didn't even know Zell, and now I practically lived with her. Zell waved her hand in the air. "Oh, well, it doesn't matter. You're okay, and I've got exciting news." She put her arm around my shoulders and began walking me back toward her house. She kind of stunk after working on the habitat all morning, but I didn't dare say so. When she said she had news for me, I honestly thought she was going to tell me that Mr. John said he'd dig us a pond. I was starting to feel at home with Zell and John, starting to think we might actually finish this project of ours. I wasn't even thinking about Cutter. The truth was, lately, I hadn't thought about my mom and brother much at all. First, my selfishness had landed my brother in the hospital. Then I went off and lived the good life while he was there and forgot all about him. I was the worst sister in the world. "Yeah?" I asked. "What is it?" I was already thinking of the special fish I'd asked Zell to buy for the pond. I'd seen them on a show on TV before. They were big and fat and orange, like overgrown goldfish. I would name them. "Your brother's awake," Zell said. "We've got to get ready and get up to the hospital." She beamed at me, and I felt the popsicle start to drip down my hand. He's going to be so happy to see you. She gave me a little hug, and I made my face smile back at her, because I should have been happy. I mean, I was happy. Relieved, too. But in the same moment, at the exact same time, I was sad, too, because I would be going home, possibly as soon as that night. No more dinners with Mr. John and Zell. No more Zell asking, "So what do we feel like for supper?" No more wildlife habitat. No more going over to hang out with Lila next door. No more waking up on the sofa with an afghan covering me because Zell thought I looked cold. I'd have to take my 4th of July trophy off her mantle. "That's great," I said, hoping I sounded the way a normal kid would when she heard that her brother, who might have died, wasn't going to die after all. "I can't wait to see him." When tears welled in my eyes, I made it seem like it was because I was so relieved. And I was. But I was also thinking about what it would be like to go back to being the one who took care of people, instead of being the one who got cared for. Zell and I took showers super fast and got dressed. I met her downstairs in the kitchen, and she handed me a big, shiny apple. "You haven't had lunch, and I don't think that popsicle is going to hold you." She gave me a wink that told me I was forgiven. "We'll go get lunch after the hospital to celebrate. How's that sound?" It sounded nice. It sounded like a fitting end to what had been the best summer I could remember. On the way to the hospital, we passed a billboard of that little girl who disappeared. It had a big picture of her, smiling and looking at us all as we drove past, heading to our everyday lives while she remained lost. I could tell it was her school picture. School pictures always look the same, no matter what school you go to. I'd been to enough to know. The billboard asked the question, "Have you seen me?" with a phone number and the promise of a big reward for anyone who helped find her. It gave me the heebie-jeebies, and I had to look away really quickly, even though her face stayed in my mind. I saw Zell notice it, too, but neither of us said anything about it, even though I knew both of us were thinking about earlier when Zell couldn't find me. Zell had it wrong, though. Mr. Doyle was a nice man who was just a little lonely. He had to take care of other people a lot, so he didn't have the greatest life. I understood how that felt. After we passed the billboard, we stopped and got candy and balloons for Cutter, and I got him a puzzle he could work on now that he was awake. It was a picture of Superman flying through the air, his fist raised. If I had been brave enough, I would have told Cutter that he was Superman, surviving drowning the way he did. But sometimes it was hard for me to say mushy stuff to other people, especially if other people were watching. I got butterflies in my stomach when we parked in the lot at the hospital, and they spread their wings and started flying around when we got into the elevator to go up to the 8th floor, where Cutter was. I was worried about seeing him and my mom. I was afraid of what she would say to me, the way she would look at me, her smile frozen on her face for Zell's sake, but her eyes cold and hard. I was nervous about Cutter looking at me with those dark eyes of his, eyes that told the real story about what had happened at the pool that day, how I'd failed him. The elevator door opened, and Zell reached out and gave my hand a quick squeeze. In just a few weeks, family had become strangers, and strangers had become family. I took a deep breath and followed Zell down the hall, my feet heavy as I walked past the framed artwork done by sick children. I kept my chin up, trying not to think about those suffering children taking crayon to paper, and made myself smile at the nurses as they walked by. When at last we reached room number 810, the butterflies were whipping around my stomach so hard I felt like I might need to lean against the wall. But Zell pushed open the door, without even knocking, and I had no choice but to follow her inside my brother's hospital room. I think it was because Zell didn't knock first that we caught Mom and the man together, leaning against each other the way only two people who are very comfortable would do, his arm casually tossed across her shoulders. If they'd had some warning, I bet my mother would have put some distance between them and not looked so cozy. She hadn't let Joe come around us for the first several months they dated. I wish she'd never let him come around at all. But I guess this was a different situation. I recognized the ambulance guy right away. He was the one who had stopped and talked to me while the other two got cutter loaded into the back. He was nice and everything, but jeez, how did he end up with his arm around my mother? In the split second between when the door opened and when they realized we weren't just another nurse entering the room, I got the picture. They weren't hiding anything from Cutter. He was sitting up in bed picking at a tray of food on a table stretched across his bed. They were laughing at something Cutter said, and he was laughing too. And for just a moment, I wondered if maybe it would be better for all of us, them too, not just me, if I stayed with Zell and let them be a family. They looked comfortable and familiar, like they belonged together. And when their heads swiveled around to take in Zell and me standing in the doorway motionless, it was clear just who the outsider was. I felt Zell's hand come to rest on my shoulder, and then she said with that bright, happy voice she used sometimes, "We came to see the miracle boy." She pointed to the stuff I was carrying. "And we brought presents." My mother got up and rushed over to me, wrapping her arms around me and hugging me so big I could hardly breathe. Ambulance guy came over and took the things from my hand, exclaiming, "Cool! Look, Cutter!" a little too loudly. From inside my mother's arms, I could see Cutter. He gave me that Cutter grin I had seen 1,001 times before, and in that moment, with my mother hugging me and the ambulance guy in the room and Zell saying all her Zell things, it hit me. Cutter was okay. He was okay. He was okay. Which meant, I guessed, so was I. Lance. In the year before Deborah left, she'd gotten into new foods, her devotion to all things healthy pursued with a kind of zeal usually attributed to cult followers. She'd eaten carrots dipped in hummus and smoothies made with strange ingredients, and apples dipped in almond butter instead of peanut butter. "What's wrong with peanuts?" Lance had asked, but she hadn't answered, already buzzing to the next thing. She'd never stayed still, as if the healthy foods were giving her excess energy she had to keep moving to burn off. She'd eschewed anything made with flour or sugar, waxing eloquent on how fruits had all the natural sugar she'd ever need. She'd made and devoured huge salads, nibbled on nuts and seeds, avoided beef in favor of chicken or seafood. She'd rarely spoken to him unless it was to sermonize over the health benefits of the foods she was eating and, therefore, foisting on the entire family. There had never been anything good to eat in the house. He'd grumbled and complained, even as the weight fell off her and she'd started to resemble the girl he'd married again. Trouble was, she'd acted nothing like that girl. She'd taken up running. She ran all the time, even when it rained. "Shouldn't you join a gym or something?" he'd asked, concerned as she'd taken off into the rain one cold day when he was sure she'd catch her death. "You could run on a treadmill. Wouldn't that be safer?" Deborah hadn't answered. She'd just run away. She even ran in her sleep, a phenomenon he'd witnessed one night as she'd lain splayed in their bed, sleep sacking her mid-sentence. Her mouth had still been open, her unspoken words escaping into the air. He'd watched her, wishing he had the courage to rouse her and tell her all he was thinking. "I feel like I'm losing you. I fear that we're drifting apart. And yet you seem so happy, so purposeful, for the first time since the kids were born, and I'm scared to death to mess with that." He'd watched her sleep and thought of all the things he couldn't say to his wife. Watching her, he'd noticed twitching under the sheets, and it had taken him a moment to realize she was running, even in her dreams. Her feet had moved as though she were rhythmically plodding along the asphalt. Even in her sleep, he could see in hindsight she'd been running away. Lance watched for Jency and her girls to arrive in that mammoth SUV she drove. He was always a little shocked when he saw a tiny woman climb out from behind the wheel of one of those intimidating vehicles. He wasn't even sure he wanted to drive a car that big, that high, through traffic and down narrow suburban streets. And yet, he'd seen many a mom whip one of those things into a parking space without a second thought. He busied himself by emptying the dishwasher, a chore he normally made the kids do. Deborah hadn't required them to do enough around the house, and that only added to her stress and unhappiness, in his opinion. But he needed a distraction, so he'd stop pacing by the front windows, looking out for Jency, who must have been going for fashionably late. He hoped she hadn't forgotten about their date. He scolded himself for even thinking that word. This was not a date. And yet, he looked forward to spending time with her, had spent the better part of the day with an anticipatory grin on his face. Lila had even noticed it. "Stop smiling, Dad," she scolded. "It makes you look weird." He'd done his best to comply with her request, forming his lips into a straight line. But moments later, he was smiling again. Lila shook her head and went outside to investigate whatever Zell and Kaylee were up to in the Boyette backyard. They'd been outside a lot lately, busy as beavers. He supposed he should be neighborly and inquire, but he'd been preoccupied with thoughts of Jency, coinciding with more and more memories of Deborah and thoughts about it being over. He was, he knew, beginning to let his wife go. But letting her go meant he had to find her and do it officially, which was an idea that was forming more and more each day, almost independent of his conscious thought life. His subconscious was deciding for him. It was time to move on, to pronounce the time of death on his marriage and start living, for real, again. He saw the SUV pull into his driveway and tried not to attach symbolism to its appearance at that moment. And yet, as Jency climbed out of the big vehicle, he felt his heart lift and hoped that when she saw him waiting for her in the doorway, maybe hers did, too. He raised his hand in greeting, and she gave him that smile he'd been waiting to see, the one that made him think about a future apart from Deborah, something he hadn't thought was possible. Jency. Jency was on a rooftop with Arch, sitting at a cafe table overlooking a splendid view of the city below on a perfect day. Arch was wearing the dark gray Armani suit she loved, with a crisp white shirt and a deep red tie. The gray suit complemented his starting to silver dark hair, and he was tan from a recent trip to Miami that he swore had been no fun at all. He couldn't stand the clients, he'd said upon his return. She saw the lie, but said nothing. They sipped champagne, the bubbles tickling her nose as they always did, making her feel happy and light. He reached for her hand and took it across the table, trailed his fingers up and down the soft inner skin of her forearm, a signal that he wanted to make love later. She wasn't even sure he knew he did it, but she knew his cues. She knew everything about him. Suddenly, a group of men in black suits surrounded them, guns drawn, shouting, "Mr. Wells, you're under arrest!" She began to shake her head. No, 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 this couldn't be happening. They were having drinks before a lovely dinner in the restaurant downstairs. She was going to have she-crab soup, because she'd heard it was excellent there, and she loved a good she-crab soup. The delicate meat, the rich creamy broth with a hint of sherry, if it was made right. After dinner, they were going back to their hotel to climb into bed. How could these men drag him away? What right did they have? "Arch!" she cried, attempting to lunge toward him, even though one of the men restrained her. "Arch, don't let them do this!" He looked back at her, his face a mask of panic and terror. He turned from her and allowed the men to drag him away. She turned to the man holding her back and tried to look into his eyes, but the black glasses he wore prevented her from seeing them. She pulled them off, only to find that where eyes should be, there were just vacant black holes. His mouth opened, and before she could scream, the man in black spoke to her. "Jency," he said, "wake up." She opened her own eyes to find herself on Lance's couch, her legs thrown across his knees with an inappropriate air of familiarity, Monty Python frozen on the TV screen. He stared at her, his brows knitted together. "Sorry I woke you," he said. "You were having a nightmare." She sat up quickly and pulled her legs to herself, self-conscious. She blamed the wine they'd had before the movie started, while the kids scampered around the backyard playing the same night games she'd once played in this neighborhood. Freeze tag, hide-and-seek, capture the flag, the games made more difficult by the darkening sky. They'd drunk several glasses on his deck before herding the kids upstairs and into their pajamas to watch their own movie in the bonus room, freeing the two of them to be alone in the den. She'd felt loose and warm and comfortable when they'd started the movie, and between the darkened room, the cozy couch, and the effects of the wine, she'd started fading only a few minutes into the movie. Still disoriented, she looked back at this man who was not Arch, blinking for a few seconds as she tried to recall what this nightmare had been about. What had been so clear and vivid minutes ago was quickly dissolving into a murky memory of disturbing images. The images faded, leaving behind feelings of threat and foreboding. It was always this way. Many of the nightmares were similar. She had a husband, and then he was gone. Her brain kept dreaming up a new and creative way to lose him. Though the dreams were different, the sense of loss was persistent. I don't remember what it was about, she said, hugging her legs to herself and looking at her hands, wrapped around her legs. I just remember being really scared. She felt his eyes on her, but she couldn't look back at him. If she looked at him, she would spill the secret. And she didn't feel ready to talk to this man she barely knew about the ugliest part of her life. She liked him and didn't want him to think less of her. What if he, like Arch, thought she was somehow complicit in what Arch had done? What if he kept his distance from her once he knew the truth? This was hardly first date conversation. Maybe you were dreaming you were a witch about to be burned at the stake, he quipped. She laughed. That was the scene they'd watched just before she'd faded into sleep. She was grateful to him for lightening the mood. She liked him enough not to screw it up by draping her woes on the top of their evening. That was probably it, she said. And yet, he'd had no qualms in telling her that his wife had decided she needed time away from their marriage, walking out and leaving him and the children. What happened to cause her to do that? She wondered. She got the feeling he was leaving it up to Jency to decide if he was at fault, to determine for herself if he deserved to be left. She studied his profile as he looked back at the image, frozen on the television screen. He certainly didn't look like someone who deserved to be walked out on. Does anyone? She pointed at the TV, the image of a man on a horse banging coconuts together. What I miss? She asked. She forced herself to smile. I could easily rewind back to where you fell asleep so you won't miss anything, he teased. He scooted closer to her and gave her what she guessed was his attempt at a leer, but with his baby face he couldn't quite pull it off. Or... He pulled her to him. She let herself be embraced, let herself feel comforted by his arms encircling her. Counting the hug after the fireworks and the hug when she arrived, this was the third hug of their relationship. Was that what it was? A relationship? A friendship? Friends hugged one another all the time. She felt his eyes on her and turned her face to look back at him. The only light in the room came from the TV. Upstairs, from a distance and behind a closed door, she could hear tinny cartoon music. She wondered if they were still awake. Reading her mind, he said, I think they all passed out. She swallowed. Oh. She licked her lips 1 second before his lips landed on hers. The kiss lasted less than a second, no more than what she'd give one of her girls before bed, a peck. He fixed her with his gaze, his mouth so close she could feel his breath on her lips. Should I apologize? She supposed the right answer, the responsible answer was, it's too soon. But she liked the smell of his skin, the gentleness in his eyes, the way the light from the television made everything in the room look blue. You really think they're asleep? She asked. She arched one eyebrow up, a talent Bright had always envied, and wondered if he saw it in the dark. He grinned his response. Want me to go check? She nodded, and he sprang up like a released coil, trotting away and up the stairs. She had seconds to come to her senses, to talk herself out of whatever came next, to determine just how far she would go. She was just passing through. Last week she'd talked to an old friend from college who had her own all-female law practice in Virginia and could hire her to do admin stuff. She would most likely start over there and leave this neighborhood behind just like she'd left it before. And this night, this man, would be just a fun blip, a funny little confession for the girlfriends she'd have in the future about the night she behaved badly. They would titter over her admission, raise their glasses in a toast to strong women. When those girlfriends asked, "How'd you ever get through it?" she'd tell them about finding hidden money and eating McDonald's and living with her parents and seeking consolation in the arms of someone else who'd also been left. She'd smile bravely and inspire them. The scene played out in her mind like one from Sex and the City, and she remembered Everett's words. Maybe it could still come true. She heard Lance's footsteps returning. "They're all out. Crashed," he said. She could hear the smile in his voice without even looking at him. He bent down and kissed her again, this time as tentative as before. He straightened up and extended his hand, an invitation. She knew just where he would lead her if she took his hand. She looked up at him and blinked once, then reached up with her own hand, lacing her fingers through his as he pulled her to him for the fourth time. Now Jency awoke in Lance's house for the second time, but this time it was light outside, and no nightmare had awakened her. She stretched, lifting her arms above her head as she listened to the birds chirp outside the window. She looked beside her and found the space empty, the sheets tangled and the imprint of a body the only evidence he'd ever been there. She stared at the empty spot, grateful she'd not had to wake up to him. She wasn't ready for morning conversation, for an analysis of what had happened, or even admitting it had happened at all. She'd given in to an impulse, and he'd done the same. That was all. This was what grown-ups did. They moved on and found comfort wherever they could along the way. She looked around on the floor for where her clothes had fallen, collecting them and putting them on quickly, eager to be dressed in case the girls came looking for her. At some point in the night, they'd discussed how they'd explain it to the kids, voices urgent and hushed as they concocted a story, even as they unzipped zippers and undid buttons. They'd fallen asleep watching the movie, and Lance had offered her the guest room. He would go back to his bed, and that was how their waking children would find them, separate and chaste, as far as they knew. She tried to block the images that came to mind as she dressed, her recall of last night instant and fresh in spite of how little sleep she'd gotten. She remembered how different his body, his smell, his touch was from Arch's. Arch had been tall and wiry. Lance was almost exactly her height and broad-chested. Arch was dark. Lance was light. Arch always smelled of this expensive cologne that he applied a bit too liberally, though she never said so. Lance smelled like Dial soap. Dressed, she turned her attention to making up the bed. As she straightened and smoothed the twisted sheets, her thoughts turned to the unavoidable comparisons she'd made, even as it was happening. Arch was aggressive and in charge in the bedroom, just like in life, but Lance had been tentative and solicitous. Arch had rarely spoken during sex, but Lance had been verbal, his voice a low, compelling murmur in her ear, telling her what he was doing and asking if she liked it. He was like the eye doctor. Better this or this? Satisfied that the bed was adequately made, she left the room and her thoughts behind. She found Lance and the four kids in the kitchen. Lance was scrambling eggs and frying bacon, a pitcher of orange juice on the counter, and a pot of coffee, blessedly, at the ready. He looked over at her the moment she entered the room. "There's your mom," he said to the girls, who leaped up to greet her with hugs and kisses as if she'd been gone forever. Their eyes met over the top of the girls' heads, and he winked. "We finally got to have a sleepover, Mommy," Zara said, beaming. "Isn't that cool?" She thought suddenly of her parents at home, probably worried, or at the very least, disapproving of her staying out all night at Lance's. She hadn't answered to her parents in 15 years and wondered how it was that she was back to making excuses as to her whereabouts. She wondered if they would buy the same lie the girls had. Disentangling herself from the girls' octopus arms, she poured coffee, added cream and sugar, and sat down with the kids to wait for the food. At the stove, Lila stood stirring a pot of grits with a pensive look that told Jency she wasn't quite sure about all this. She attempted to catch the girl's eye and give her a smile, but Lila wouldn't look her way. "I'm not looking to take your mom's place," she wanted to assure her. Because she wasn't. She was just looking to fill the time between her old life and her new one, letting this strange summer back in Sycamore Glen be the transition she needed, a bench on the side of the road before she continued her journey. Lance, oblivious, just kept smiling and cooking, looking like the cat who ate the canary, a secret smile playing constantly at his lips. She thought of those same lips on hers, how they'd traveled the length of her body and back again. Though it might have been the stupidest thing she could have done, at that moment, as long as she didn't look at Lila, it didn't feel stupid at all. It felt like progress. She'd passed through a place she had to go through in order to get where she was going. It was nothing more than that. Bright. Before she could get to her intended destination, Bright had to make a stop off at Myrtle Honeycutt's to pick up Rigby. He was part of her ploy. As far as Everett was concerned, she was just going to walk the dog, like any other day. She just failed to mention that she was going to veer off the usual path and check out the hideaway while she was out. Ever since the idea had taken root on the night of the 4th, she'd felt compelled to go, to know. Though to know what, she wasn't quite sure. When Everett and Jency were dating, Wright hadn't let on that she was in love with him, at least not to anyone else. The closest she'd ever come to admitting her feelings to Jency was when they were 17 years old. Bright had uttered 3 words, exhaled like a sigh. "I want that." She'd meant she wanted Everett's love, but she guessed that Jency took it that she wanted love at all. She'd spoken so low, she wasn't even sure Jency had heard her. There'd been a pause. Then Jency had given her a little smile in response and patted her shoulder. "You will," she'd said, her quavering voice belying her words. Everyone knew that what Jency and Everett had was rare. Jency knew, but still she left it behind. It was Jency's leaving that enabled Bright to get that desperate wish. Still, she couldn't stop the doubts that plagued her mind, made her crazy. Did he ever look at Bright the way he used to look at Jency? When Bright and Everett had started trying and couldn't conceive, it was clear that she'd never give him the child they'd dreamed of together. When he was Jency's, she'd thought only about getting him. She'd never considered being a failure once she got him. Her desire, their desire, to get pregnant became her personal quest, pursued the same way she'd once pursued Everett. She thought she'd be happy when she got pregnant, that she'd get the same feeling of elation she'd experienced when she got into Chapel Hill, was elected treasurer at school, or scored her dream job. She thought she'd high-five the doctor, the nurse, and anyone else she could find, then float home on a cloud of joy to celebrate with her husband. But by the time she sat across the desk from the doctor to confirm the news, she'd been so broken, gone so far afield of what having a baby should be, that all she could do was nod mutely and ask about risks to the pregnancy. Later, when she'd told Everett the news, he'd hugged her tight, but she'd barely registered his arms around her. Her mind was elsewhere, lost in a tangle of emotions and fears. Thankfully, Everett wrote it all off to hormones, joking about her anxiety with her parents and his. But sometimes she saw her mother-in-law watching her with concern. Worried, Bright was sure, that all the negativity was somehow harming her unborn grandchild. Now she pushed that child, who seemed no worse for the wear. Her mother had promised her that babies were resilient, and, as always, she'd been right. In his stroller up to Myrtle Honeycutt's back door. Myrtle had been old when Bright had lived here as a kid, so she was positively ancient now. Her dog, Rigby, was a medium-sized mutt of indeterminate origin who had more energy than Myrtle could handle. But the dog was a good companion for her, living all alone. And Christopher loved his daily dose of dog. It was like having one, only not. She rapped lightly on the door and heard Myrtle's shuffling steps in response. Her wavering voice called out, "I'm a-comin'," just like it always did. And when she opened the door, she already had Rigby on the leash, just like she always did. There had been a bad spell a few weeks ago when Myrtle seemed confused when Bright came to the door. Then she couldn't find the leash. Bright had feared the end was near, but then she'd snapped right out of it. Bright hated to think what they would do when Myrtle passed. She guessed they'd probably inherit a dog, for starters. "You doing okay, Miss Myrtle?" she asked, just as she always did. Myrtle's answer was the one thing that varied in their routine. "Well, I expect I am," was the answer she got today, "except this heat is just ungodly." "We can thank the good Lord for inventing air conditioning, huh?" Bright asked as she cinched the leash to keep Rigby from straying too far. "I'll say," Myrtle Honeycutt agreed. She looked past Bright at Christopher in his stroller. "You mind you don't get that boy overheated now," she cautioned. "Oh, I won't, Miss Myrtle. We've got lots of water, and we'll stay under the trees in the shade," she assured her. The woods were full of shade, after all. "We'll see you back in a little bit." She gave the old woman a wave and pulled the door shut, then tugged Rigby down the stairs, fixing him at her side with the short leash as she began pushing the stroller. They made a tidy knot as they moved forward. Christopher hummed a tune from one of his TV shows, and she fell back to debating the job issue, her thoughts on an endless loop of pros and cons. Christopher was getting older, and another baby was impossible without intervention. If she got a job, that would make it even more so, and give her a reason to indefinitely postpone going back to the fertility clinic with Everett, like he was pushing for. It wasn't really about the job. It never was. The job was just the lesser of the two evils. If she re-entered the workforce, she would have a reason to tell Everett it wasn't a good time to go through infertility treatments. She knew that would placate him, for a while at least. Someday she might have to tell him the truth about why she never wanted to go back to the clinic, but her intent was to avoid that as long as possible. The way she saw it, she had no choice but to follow up with Trent Miller. He could connect her with the best opportunities in her field and potentially link her to a better situation than her former job. With the gap she'd taken to have Christopher, she needed an edge. His references and contacts would be invaluable, his interest a little push for her past boss to step up any new offer he was thinking about. She grew more certain about this decision as she walked to find the hideaway, to confirm with her own eyes that it was still there, preferring to think about her job prospects than whether Everett could be meeting Jency in their former meeting place. She tightened Rigby's leash. Up ahead, she saw Zell Boyette and Kaylee in Zell's front yard, both of them staring down at something, unmoving. As she got closer, the little girl looked up and waved, then ran toward them calling Christopher's name. Kaylee always asked to help Bright with Christopher at the pool.
"Wanna come see what we're doing?" Kaylee asked, breathless and grinning.
Bright wondered what the latest was on Cutter. She'd heard through the neighborhood grapevine that he'd woken up and was on the mend. She wondered why, then, Kaylee was still with Zell. From his stroller, Christopher held up his arms for Kaylee, eager to escape his confines and knowing a sucker when he saw one.
"Sure," she said, releasing him.
Kaylee pulled him out of the stroller and carried him over to Zell, balancing his heft even though he was half her size.
"Hello," Zell called to Bright. "Don't mind me, I look a sight."
The older woman wasn't exaggerating. She was streaked with dirt, and her hair stood up in clumps around her head. She laughed at Bright's expression.
"Is it that bad?"
Bright came over to peer down into what was, so far, a small circle of dirt in Zell's front yard.
"We're making a koi pond," Zell explained.
"It's for our wildlife habitat," Kaylee added.
She turned to Christopher and pointed at the hole,
changing her voice to a baby voice when she spoke to him.
"We're going to put water in that hole and make a pond," she said. "And then we're going to add fishies."
"Fishies?" Christopher asked. His little eyebrows scrunched together, and he looked so much like his father. Bright turned to Zell.
"This is quite a project," she said.
"Kaylee and I are trying to get it finished before she goes back home," Zell said.
"Can I take Christopher to the backyard so we can see the feeders?" Kaylee's question was posed to both of them, and they answered in unison, "Sure."
They looked at each other and laughed.
Intent on keeping hold of Christopher, Kaylee lurched toward the backyard with her arms locked around him. Bright heard him say,
"Wanna get down?"
But she couldn't hear Kaylee's response. She wished the girl luck. He was not easily dissuaded once he got something into his mind. In that way, he was like his father, too.
"I heard Cutter's doing better, thank the Lord. So when is Kaylee heading home? I'm sure you'll miss having her," Bright said.
Zell nodded. "Cutter's coming home from the hospital in the next day or two, but he's going to be back and forth doing all kinds of rehab stuff. Lisa, God bless her, doesn't know which ends up. She's exhausted and, get this, seems to have taken up with the ambulance driver from the pool that day, if you can believe that. So she's got a new relationship to boot." Zell waved her arm in the air. "I don't know. It just doesn't seem to be the best environment to send Kaylee back to right now. So I offered to keep her just a little bit longer while they get settled. Lisa's come by a few times to see her, and she's taking her out to dinner soon. I know she misses Kaylee, but she agreed to let her stay. I think on one level, Lisa was relieved."
Wright couldn't imagine letting her child spend such a long time away from her. But then again, Bright wasn't a single mom with two kids, living in the eyesore house of the neighborhood and juggling two jobs, trying to make ends meet.
"That was nice of you," Bright offered, for lack of something better to say.
Zell laughed. "Nice of me?" She shook her head. "I get just as much out of that child being here as she does."
Zell thought about it.
"Maybe more."
"She's a sweet kid."
Zell nodded. "That she is."
She picked up the shovel and scooped out another bit of dirt, carefully depositing it on top of the small mound they'd created.
"So, what brings you this way today?"
"Just out taking a walk."
She held up Rigby's leash, though the dog had flopped down beside her.
"I walk Myrtle Honeycutt's dog every day. My mom used to do it, but then she got plantar fasciitis and couldn't do it anymore. So I said I would." She shrugged. "It makes me get out."
"Well, it sounds like I'm not the only do-gooder around here."
Zell gave her a wink and scooped out more dirt. Bright felt like she should grab a shovel and help.
"Gonna have any more, you think?"
Zell asked. Her face was turned toward the hole, and for that Bright was grateful. It was amazing how people could toss that question off so casually. People had been doing it with some regularity since Christopher turned two, as if it were up to them to determine when it was time for Bright and Everett to add to their family.
"Well, we had a bit of trouble even having him, so I'm not sure there'll be any more."
She gave her standard response and looked around, wishing Kaylee would bring Christopher back so she could go. The silence between the women lengthened, and Bright searched for words to fill it.
"Do you ever think about coming back to the book club?"
She thought she saw Zell's shoulders tense at the question, but it could have just been from the shoveling.
"I just joined a few months back, and they told me you used to be part of it. I know they'd love to have you back."
Zell leaned on the shovel and studied her for a moment.
"I'll give it some thought," she winked, "since you asked."
"Okay," Brett answered. "I can send you the list of titles for the fall. We've only decided on books till the end of the year. Your email's in the directory, right?"
Zell nodded.
"That it is."
On the ground, the dog made a whimpering noise and rested his head on his paws, looking mournful.
"I guess I'd better get going," Bright said.
"Kaylee!"
Zell called.
Bring Christopher back here. His mama's ready to go.
Bright wondered if she was actually ready, then realized it didn't matter whether she was or not. She was on her way. She tried steering Christopher's stroller over the roots and branches and piles of dead leaves in the woods, but the overgrown path was just too precarious. One miscalculation of a root, and she could accidentally topple the stroller. And negotiating both the dog and the child wasn't the easiest thing. She stood still for a moment, determining just how to get back here. She'd come far enough to be able to make out the clearing where the hideaway had been. She was too close not to lay eyes on it, to see if it matched what lived in her memory. Though this was a fool's errand, she didn't want to abandon it. She unlatched Christopher and pulled him up into her arms, much as Kaylee had done earlier. She held him close as they moved deeper into the woods and clung tightly to Rigby's leash. Without the stroller to manage, she made it to the clearing quickly, Christopher heavy in her arms. He did not ask to get down, didn't protest being carried. He was quite calm and docile, taking in the cool or dark surroundings with a kind of acceptance, as if this were an everyday activity for the two of them. He did not ask questions as he normally would have, did not point to the squirrels and birds they passed. He just looked around with those knit, curious brows. She kissed his cheek, and he rewarded her with a grin. His breath, so close to her face, smelled of the cookies Zell had given to him before they left her house. Bright looked around, trying to remember what the place used to look like, ascertaining whether it had changed. The trees were a bit taller, the vegetation perhaps denser, but otherwise she knew exactly where she was. She heard a branch snap and a rustling noise, and she took a step back in the direction they'd come from. These woods had creeped her out as a kid, and they didn't seem less foreboding now that she was an adult. She thought of the news reports of Hannah Sumner, gone missing from a neighborhood nearby, one very much like this one. They'd discussed her at the pool just recently, swapping bits of information they'd gleaned from various news reports and rumors, their voices low and out of earshot of the kids. She thought of the madness that would ensue if Christopher ever went missing. Losing him would be the end of her. This she knew more certainly than anything. She pulled him tighter still, and he squirmed in protest. He pointed at the copse of trees ahead. They reached Everett and Jensie's hideaway.
"Go in there?" he asked.
She set him down but kept hold of his hand, scanning the area as she did just to make sure. There was talk of coyotes in these woods as well. She looked down at him, willed herself to relax.
"You want to?"
He nodded vigorously, his brows unknotting, his face open. They moved closer to the hideaway. She took exaggerated tiptoe steps forward like Elmer Fudd hunting wabbits, and Christopher laughed. They were on an adventure. Nothing more, nothing less. But how would she explain to Everett if he mentioned it that night at the dinner table? She would have to say they were somewhere else. That was all. She could lie to Everett. "I just want to be friends," was the first lie she ever told him, just after that make-out session in ninth grade. Jensie had been away with her family, and Bright had made a good stand-in, a practice dummy. This was before Everett and Jensie had officially coupled off, but everyone knew it was coming. Bright's lie had been a preemptive strike, an attempt to save face before he chose Jensie. What happened between them that one night, she told herself, and him, meant nothing. She stuck to that particular story for a long, long time, right up until the night she admitted her real feelings for him, the night everything changed between them, and he became hers for real. But there'd always been that nagging doubt that it wasn't real. Pushing the branches back, she held her breath and stepped inside the hideaway, hoping that she didn't find that same blow-up mattress and evidence that her husband and Jensie had resumed their meetings somehow. She exhaled as she stepped inside, finding nothing at all save a little clearing, the trees encircling them and blocking all visibility except the small patch of sky just over their heads. She looked up at it, the neat round bit of blue, the only thing she could see that wasn't green. She pointed at the natural skylight so Christopher would look up, too, thinking as she did of how Jency and Everett would lie on that blow-up mattress and wish on whatever stars they could find in that circle, their arms folded behind their heads, their eyes intent on what lay in front of them. The scene was almost like her own memory, even though she'd never witnessed it, only heard about it from Jency. Bright knew full well what Jency's wishes were, even if she wasn't privy to Everett's back then. She wondered if those old wishes depressed Jency now. She could only guess at what her husband's wishes had been, and if the life they'd built together looked anything like whatever he'd thought of when he watched the stars twinkle in that small circle of sky. Everett. With Bright out of the house, Everett was able to search online for that doctor's number without her seeing. He'd been looking it up earlier when she'd come to tell him she was leaving, startling him as much as if he'd been caught looking at porn. He'd quickly flipped back to another screen before she saw, waiting for her to leave before he tried again. He got up and watched from the front window until she was safely out of sight, her back moving steadily away from him as she pushed Christopher in the stroller to go get Rigby. He wondered what she would say if she knew he was going through with his idea to talk to the doctor, to get things moving along. He knew she was scared. He knew that the fertility issues leading up to the pregnancy had been hard on her, harder than anyone could understand. Something had changed in Bright, beginning when they didn't immediately conceive, and spiraling progressively downward the longer pregnancy eluded them. By the time she got pregnant, it almost seemed too late that the damage, psychological, physical, had already happened. He'd urged her to go to support groups, to talk to someone, but she'd steadfastly refused. Ultimately, it was Christopher who brought her back, but she wasn't interested in ever doing it again. And yet, he saw his son growing up like he did, an only child, always alone, and he didn't want that for him. He'd worked on Bright for several months, but was getting nowhere. The only thing he knew that might jumpstart things was to make a grand gesture. And making an appointment to talk to the doctor himself was the best idea he could think of. When she learned he'd done that, surely she'd see how serious he was, how much he wanted this. If he could go, maybe she'd muster the courage to do the same. Granted, his part in the process had been minimal, but what man in his right mind voluntarily goes to a fertility specialist without his wife forcing him to do so? It had to make an impression. It just had to. He spoke to the nurse, who seemed confused by what he was asking. "And this is an appointment for your wife, sir?" she asked. "Actually, it's just for me," he said, "to talk to the doctor myself." He could feel his face reddening. "It's highly irregular for a husband to come in without the wife, sir," she said, her voice clipped. "Yes, I realize that, but I'm just trying to gauge what we're looking at this time around, and since we worked with Dr. Ferguson in the past, I thought perhaps he could, talk me through what we can expect, just in case there's anything I can do to get the ball rolling, so to speak." He cringed at that particular choice of words. "I see," the nurse said, but the note of doubt in her voice told Everett that she didn't see at all. She was humoring him at this point, leaving the rest to the doctor to sort out. She made the appointment, wished him a good day, and hung up. He held the dead phone and tried to feel something other than foolish, something akin to hope. He strode over to the mantel and pulled down the photo his parents had snapped at Easter, the one on the front steps with him and Christopher in those goofy matching ties, Bright in a pretty spring dress. He tried to see the three of them as any other person might. Did they look like a complete family? He didn't think so. He squinted at the photo and tried to see another child there with them, another boy or maybe a little girl, one who would turn their triangle into a square, the one who would make their lives complete. He looked for the place where he or she might fit, if only his wife would make room. Zell. 2 days after the visit to the hospital, She could feel herself getting sick. Those places were germ factories. She made it through the morning without letting on to Kaylee, but by lunchtime, she couldn't fake it any longer. She told the child to occupy herself and sank into the couch for a little rest. She pulled the Afghan over her and rolled over to her side so that her vantage point was the den windows, which faced the house next door. Jensie's car was there, again, and she didn't know how to feel about that. She closed her eyes and thought of Deborah's leaving and whether it was time to tell Lance what she knew about it. The thought of telling him made her feel sicker. She could anticipate the look on his face, the betrayal that would spread across his normally open features the longer she talked. Before Deborah and Lance had lived in that house, she'd never befriended the people who lived there, never really had time to. She was always dashing off to activities and commitments, running one child here and another there. John joked that they ought to put in one of those revolving doors like they have in hotels so that he and Zell and the kids could actually run in circles instead of just feeling like they were. She always felt bad for not being more neighborly, but really, who had the time? When Deborah and Lance moved in and it turned out they were Yankees, well, that just cinched it. She certainly didn't have time to fool with Yankees who didn't know how things were done. They put tacky blow-up characters in their yard at Christmas. Their Halloween decorations were just plain evil-looking and, if you asked her, disturbing to children. They launched fireworks in the street on New Year's Eve and set all the neighborhood dogs to barking to the point that she couldn't sleep a wink and was tired all through New Year's Day. She could hardly make her pork and collards and black-eyed peas like she was supposed to. Still and all, she minded her manners and smiled in passing at Deborah or Lance if they were in their driveway. Sometimes she gave a little wave. She'd watched with a detached fascination as Deborah had their second child, a son. She saw Deborah pose in front of the gigantic, and tacky if you asked her, stork they put in the front yard, holding up the pinch-faced baby, looking swollen and strung out. Zell felt equal parts envy and relief as she watched the scene play out. Oh, to do it all over again. Thank God I never have to do that again. And yet, as she watched Deborah maneuver the baby blankets so that Lance could get their son's face in the photo, Zell tried to recall the day she'd brought any of her babies home, the feelings and thoughts she must have had. She aimed for some vivid, standout recollection, crisp and clear in her mind. But all she could turn up was a vague sense of exhaustion and panic. She wondered if she'd retained any of the experiences of motherhood, the scope of it, if the joy would ever start to outweigh the anxiety. She felt as though she'd been sucked up into a whirlwind and periodically touched down long enough to look around, register the unfamiliar scenery, only to be sucked up and tossed about again. She'd taken them a loaf of quick bread, still warm and smelling of chocolate and bananas, and knocked on the door, intending to leave it and dash away. Deborah had answered the door, looking haggard, but glad for company. "Please come in," she'd said, and the please sounded less polite than desperate. Zell agreed and found a seat at the nearby kitchen table. Deborah sat across from her. In her arms, a bundle of blue squirmed. "You want to hold him?" The note of hopefulness in her voice told her she needed Zell to say yes. Deborah thrust Alec into her arms before she'd even finished nodding. She dutifully studied the baby, making appropriate comments about his size and features. "Who does he look like, do you think?" "I think my father, but of course Lance thinks he looks just like him." Deborah laughed, and Zell joined in, though she didn't fully understand the joke. They limped through small talk, covering the weather and the local schools and the headlines, but it was conversation, and it filled the dead air. She'd played the part of the good neighbor that afternoon, and that had been, very nearly, that. She watched as the boy grew from baby to toddler to kid, registering the changes from afar, just as she'd always done with the people who lived in that house, being a tolerable neighbor, if not an especially good one. And then one day she'd heard screaming in their driveway. Her mother's ears twitched at the sound, which was especially loud in her quiet house. She put down the book she was reading, She had book club that night and was cramming. The screaming was horrific, as if someone was being murdered. She grabbed the phone just in case she needed to call 911. She peered out the kitchen window to get a better look.